The Wisconsin Medical Examining Board recently adopted new guidelines governing the prescription of opioids. The new guidelines come as the nation deals and reels with an epidemic of opioid and heroin addiction, overdoses, and deaths. I want to thank three physicians who are familiar with the issues of pain management and the new guidelines. I want to thank for participating in this Newsmakers. To my left is Dr. Michael Miller. He's the medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center of Rogers Memorial Hospital. To his left is Dr. Tim Westlake, who's vice chair of the Wisconsin Medical Examining Board. And Dr. Michael McNett is a pain physician and a member of the Wisconsin Medical Society's Opioid Committee. Gentlemen, thanks for making time to come in.
Thank you. Thanks.
Let's talk about this from a 10,000 foot level. Why is a nation reeling with an epidemic of heroin abuse, opiate abuse? So can we start there, and then we'll focus on the guidelines. So go ahead, any and all.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I practice addiction medicine, so I'm the past president of both the Wisconsin and American Societies of Addiction Medicine, so that's probably why I was tabbed to join you this morning.
And we're glad you're here.
Absolutely. I love Wisconsin. There is an epidemic without a doubt. It means cases many more than you would expect. There's been a real spike, and I think availability of the addictive substance is the relevant point here. Addiction is not really caused by drugs. Addiction is a brain disease that affects susceptible individuals. But when that individual has exposure to a highly rewarding substance, they can lose control with that. And the availability of opioid prescription painkillers, as well as heroin, has really skyrocketed in the last 25 years. And the graphs just line up perfectly. More prescribing, more prescriptions in circulation, more people with the disease, more people in the ER, more people in addiction treatment, more heroin, and this is where we are, and the guidelines are intended to do something with supply.
More hearts broken. Dr. Tim, your perspective on the why?
Yeah, so I agree totally. My kind of job in all this was to help to formulate and implement the state's regulatory strategy in combating the epidemic. So we had to look at, you know, because 25 years ago this wasn't an issue. Like Dr. Miller was saying, it wasn't as much of a problem. There's always been problems with opioids. There's always been problems with other substances. But what has been the cultural shift that caused this kind of explosion, 400% increase in the amount of opioids prescribed?
And 400% over what period? Doc?
Over the last 15 years, I believe.
Thank you.
And so we looked into that, and what it comes down to is it's been a change in the prescriptive practices in the culture, and a lot of that comes out of some well-intentioned regulation that had to do with pain scale measurement, and you know the pain is the fifth vital sign, those kind of programs that came out about 20 years ago, that the premise was that we were under-treating pain, and that physicians needed to be more responsible in treating it, and that the treatment would be opioids. That was coupled with the release of these really super potent long-acting, high dose opioids like OxyContin and MS-Contin and things, and that it with you know there's kind of the perfect storm of regulatory change and then educational change where they, you know, the teaching was that there was no limit on what you could prescribe, so you instead of saying well we should really just only hold it for people that have like end stage end of life kind of pain, you can prescribe it for chronic pain throughout anywhere and there's no limit on it, so now you get this huge overprescription problem. And so what we're trying to do from a regulatory perspective is kind of rein that back into just kind of a more normal prescribing patterns and say, you know, back to, you know, instead of you know, just getting it more aligned with what is really in the patient's best interest because it's not in the best interest.
And our other Dr. Mike?
Yeah, it really goes back to, it has its beginnings really in the palliative care and hospice programs.
Yes.
That recognized that we were not treating people with cancer well enough, and so there was this move toward more aggressive treatment with opioids for end-of-life care and cancer care. Then in 1996, OxyContin was approved, and Purdue Pharmaceuticals marketed it very, very aggressively. They were really behind a lot of the change because they marketed it as non-addicting because it was long-acting. There was no data to support that, but that's what they did. And then the American Pain Society was founded, and that was actually heavily subsidized by Purdue, and they were the ones that originally came up with pain as a fifth vital sign. And when this preeminent pain society was making these statements, that's what led to regulatory agencies mandating that hospitals had to treat pain aggressively, and they would lose their a certification if they didn't do that, which means that they couldn't bill for insurance. And then it went through Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services developed guidelines stating that doctors had to do this. And if they didn't keep their patients happy by doing this, they could lose part of their salary. And so it was really fairly draconian measures were imposed on the medical community to make us do this. And I was a doctor before this happened, and I was very uncomfortable doing it, but this is what was expected of us.
As a follow-up, one thing that strikes me is it's such an equal opportunity killer. I mean, you have teens or preteens and people in their 60s that are overdosing, and you have professionals and you have parents. I mean, when you read some of the incident reports just from Madison Police, I mean, they acquire maybe in the back room of a fast food, and then they drive down the street, and then they pass out, and all types of bad things happen. So it's an equal opportunity killer now? Is that a fair? Well, what do you think, Doctor?
It's very interesting to look at the epidemiology of this. And, you know, I live in Madison, as you do. And, you know, the Madison media really talked about this issue of driving while shooting and people really passing out behind the wheel, either in a parked car or a moving vehicle and driving into somebody.
Yes.
And so it really is rather scandalous that that happens. But that's generally heroin. That's more so than the pharmaceuticals. But young people, it's very interesting. The first illegal drug that high school students use used to be marijuana. Okay, and then there was the cocaine epidemic of the 80s. And opioids were just nowhere on the list. And now the first illegal drug that kids will use generally will be a prescription drug that they get at school because they circulate. Kids that have had wisdom teeth taken out, there's extra supplies around, and so there's that demographic. But it's really interesting. The overdose deaths from prescription drugs, as you pointed out, are actually more in people in their 50s. This is people being treated for chronic pain. They're not taking any heroin at all. They may be taking a benzodiazepine, which really changes the lethality quotient of this. But it does affect, certainly addiction affects all demographics. But this issue of opioid use does affect people in different walks of life. It's certainly, there's data, it's more of a problem now in rural communities than urban communities. There's no place you can think of that would be a safe haven from this. It's every American community, all 50 states, urban, rural, all age groups. And this is why, and it's not relevant to these guidelines as much, that this reference just a little bit, that we need to consider all sorts of preventive measures, but also overdose reversal measures with Narcan, and having Narcan available either by prescription or now over the counter in Wisconsin, making that available for people who have these supplies. So for instance, if you have somebody in your family who does have cancer or some other chronic pain condition for which they have large supplies at home, if there's a large supply of opioids, there should be a supply of the antidote, absolutely automatically readily available. And so maybe that was a little bit off topic, but we'll see what my colleagues have to say.
Go ahead, any PSs on that? You just participated in a forum in Oconomowoc convened by Representative Joel Clayfish, and that's Western Waukesha County, that's pretty upscale.
Sure.
And Democratic State Representative Evan Goyke represents Milwaukee, came to say, you know, I'm here because I see some of the license plates from the suburbs in my area, Milwaukee, buying some of these substances. I was just struck by that comment. But any PSs on what Dr. Miller said?
Yeah, I think, I mean, what he said was spot on. It's absolutely accurate. And where we see the overdoses, and I work in an emergency department in Oconomowoc, and where I see the overdoses is heroin, you know, mostly related. And it's the kids that start on prescription drugs, it becomes too expensive, cost prohibitive, and then, you know, 80% of the people that use heroin start with the prescription drugs, especially the kids. And so it's the kids in their early 20s that we see overdosing on the heroin. But yeah, there's a big corridor between Milwaukee and Waukesha County.
Yes. And Dr. Connection.
Yeah, I think, you know, it really is a problem because the amount of narcotics being prescribed now is astronomical. There are 9 billion pills of hydrocodone prescribed every year. And typically, only half of those are taken. So every year, 4.5 billion hydrocodone pills are piling up in people's medicine cabinets. And, you know, people are going, you know, when there's a party, people will go up to the medicine cabinet and steal the, and they'll rifle through it to steal it. It's when kids have kids over, oftentimes they'll pilfer the medicine cabinets. And some people just sell the extra. There's a widely prescribed but potent drug called oxycodone IR. A 30 milligram tablet is worth $30. So a person taking four of those a day could make $44,000 a year selling them on the street. And I've seen patients on doses that they could literally make over $500,000 a year to sell. And it's just shocking. And what's even more shocking is there have been multiple studies that have demonstrated that opioids don't even work long term. The amount of benefit a patient gets if they take it for longer than 2 months is less than they would even be capable of appreciating.
Just a follow-up question before we get into the new guidelines that the board adopted. The key to reversing this epidemic, education, treatment, and then another question I had, criminal justice system, is that at all effective? But let's focus on education or treatment. Which is more effective?
I think it's
all of the above?
I mean, from my perspective at a board, yeah, exactly. I mean, you want to have a cultural shift in physicians so that we're prescribing back at a more reasonable level, that we're not, you know, essentially over prescribing. I mean, as docs, we have to own the fact that we have been prescribing more than is really safe.
I was going to ask you about blame and how much physicians share in the blame for some of this.
We're doing that. If we weren't prescribing 400% more, then there would be, you know, 400% fewer opioid deaths, most likely, because that's the exact, I mean, like Dr. Miller was saying, the amount of that have been prescribed have mirrored exactly how much abuse there's been and how many deaths there have been. And so there's been a huge tie-in. So for me, it's a cultural shift of the prescriptions, but it's also of patients. So that's a part of my educational process in the ER. When I see someone that has a broken ankle, I'm like, you know, you've got a broken ankle, it's going to hurt. You're going to be in a lot of pain for the next week or two. You should expect that. You take anti-inflammatory medications, take the Tylenol. Here's some narcotic if you want it to take at night so you can get through the night. But you will suffer. You have a broken, you know, extremity. And so part of that is a cultural expectation, like, okay, you know, pain relief doesn't mean no pain. It means it's manageable, that you can get through until you're healed. So that's a piece of it for me, and education of the physicians and of the patients. And prevention is, like, I'm sure Mike is talking about.
I think it's like a wildfire, okay? The conditions are that create the wildfire are people are prone to addiction, but that hasn't changed. What's changed is that we have exposed them to these drugs, and so that's kind of created this dry tinder, and now the fire is raging. We have to change so that we aren't creating the conditions for people to become addicted by using our opioids much more wisely, by carefully selecting which opioids we use. Some are more addicting than others, and we need to start avoiding the more addictive opiates, like oxycodone, for example. And then, but we also have to treat the people where the horse is out of the barn. Those who are addicted aren't helped by us just stopping opioids, because they'll turn to the street. We have to provide them an alternative, and that means effective tested treatments that have been shown to help addiction. And so the addiction treatment part is has as much importance as changing the opioid prescribing.
And the sir,
you have a great panel here. You have an emergency room physician and the chair of the medical examining board, or chair-elect.
Vice chair.
Okay. So that's one perspective, but you have pain medicine on one side and addiction medicine on the other side. We are not going to treat our way out of this. We're going to have to prevent our way out of this, but we can't ignore treatment of the people, as Mike says, who already are sort of stuck in a predicament. And as we go forward, the solutions are going to have to be multifactorial, many different approaches, but physicians must be a part of it. Now, our culture, the media, news, politics, everybody loves to play the blame game. Let's find somebody to point the finger at. And it's easy to point the finger at some of the pharmaceutical manufacturers and some of the marketing. It's easy to point the finger, obviously, at anybody who writes the prescription, whether it's a dentist, a nurse practitioner, a physician, whoever. It's easy to find points of blame. We need to move forward. And what physicians need to do, and we're all leaders in the medical community, is recognize, number one, you can't say it's not a problem. Number two, you can't say we don't have a role. Number three, we have to be part of the solution. And we can be a part of the solution, not only with these prescription guidelines of prescribing somewhat differently. We can really be part of the solution by educating our patients about the situation and about the need for safe medication storage and disposal, so the medicine cabinet ceases to become the mother lode of supply for this epidemic.
I have one more general question, and I promise we'll get to the guidelines. It's this. Narcan saves lives, but does it save lives for the person who is saved to just go and overdose again? Is it a two-edged sword?
I don't see how anybody can say that saving a life is a problem. It saves a life so they have a chance to make a better decision in the future. They may make bad decisions again, but to say that somebody has been revived five times, stop reviving them, that person needs addiction treatment. We need to get them engaged with treatment. If they're not alive, we don't have the chance to have the conversation. Rescues are important. I really think everybody in the public needs to get away from this idea that addicts are to blame for their disease. They're not worth our investment in any way. Reviving them is just for another day's problems. You're reviving them so that maybe someday somebody like me will be able to help them get better. And if they're dead, I don't have any access to them. So I appreciate you bringing up the point, because you're not the only one who has that idea. But I would strongly encourage us to tone down on that idea.
I understand. But you just said that Narcan mm-hmm. gives you the ability to offer addiction treatment. My
yes.
follow-up question is, are there addiction treatment resources available? Dr. Mingdat?
If I could make a point about your previous point, I think, and I'm also trained in addiction. I don't do it primarily, but I have background in it. One of the things that I think is really important is an addict goes into treatment when they hit bottom. Okay, they have something so bad happen to them that it wakes them up and it causes what they call a window of sobriety, where the addiction is a lot like a computer virus, and it's taken over the computer. And when they have that moment of sobriety, it's like the core programming wakes up and says, wait a minute, what am I doing to myself? That is a time when they can actually get into treatment and potentially benefit from it. That's when they really want to get better. Sometimes that overdose is what causes that moment of sobriety. So Narcan plays a very, very important role, I think, in getting patients to wake up to see that they need to avail themselves of treatment.
I have a young man I admitted yesterday to Rogers, age 25. That is the exact story. Yeah. He overdosed, he wrecked his car, he came home, he needed a Narcan rescue. All these things happened in a one-week span of time. He got into treatment, first time to do this in this way. And so that's exactly the point. Some people will not use
so
this
as
an
opportunity. So he's having, to use his term, a moment of sobriety. Excuse me for a
moment. I would call it a moment of clarity.
Okay,
right.
Thank you.
Right.
Okay.
And I think it's also important when you look at this, because I had that exact question, is do you facilitate more abuse? And the thing is, the people that are addicted to opiates and heroin, they will use. And they're not going to stop because, so if you look at the states where Narcan has become highly available, they haven't seen a big upswing in addiction. What they've seen is a big decrease in deaths.
Okay.
So it's been done in other states, and it's definitely proven to not increase the amount of addicts.
Sir.
To get to your second question, I think the statistics are that narcotic addiction is so prevalent in this country, what we're now calling opioid abuse disorder. It's so prevalent in this country that every doctor probably has somewhere between 16 and 20 patients in their every primary care doctor probably has somewhere between 16 and 20 patients in their practice who would be indicated to receive treatment. If the way the law is now written, if every doctor in the state of Wisconsin got licensed to prescribe buprenorphine, which is one of the most common treatments, they're only allowed to see 30 patients in the first year. So, I mean, if every other doctor in Wisconsin was licensed, we wouldn't have enough doctors to treat the problem.
Right.
And so we have the gap between treatment and need in the state is astronomical.
Okay, now we framed the larger issue. Now we can turn, Dr. Tim, how long ago did the Medical Examining Board begin recognizing we need new guidelines, for the opiate prescriptions, and how long did it take to draft them, and what's the overall goal of them? And sure. I know all three of you worked on it, so just start with you, Dr. Tim.
Sure, so it started out with there was an awareness, I think, probably 2.5 years ago, and the state sent some leaders to the National Governors Association Best Policy Practice Academy for Reducing Prescription Drug Abuse. It was a group of six different states that put their kind of lead strategists together to try to look at what other states were doing that were successful and share what they were doing and come up with policy. So my job as the regulator and actually the only physician that prescribed opioids at that conference was to come up with a plan that of looking at what other states had done that we could best implement to Wisconsin. So it was apparent that continuing medical education based on opioid prescribing and the guidelines were key to that. And so as a medical board, we didn't have the statutory authority to promulgate guidelines. So I came back literally in January, the meeting was in November, talked to Representative Nygren about it, and he was on board right away with
it. So it was part of the
NGA,
part of the Hope bills?
Yeah. So then that was one of the Hope bills that was written was for the ability to produce guidelines.
Did you find that the old guidelines were much too lax? Encourage overprescription?
No, not really. They just weren't followed at all.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that was the issue. So I think we kind of like medicine kind of knows what needs to happen instinctively, and we kind of listened. We were kind of bended and kind of twisted and now I think what we're looking for is just the ability for the House of Medicine to regulate themselves. And that was really important for me, just like Dr. Miller talked about, was having physicians at the helm. Because I look at other states where there's regulatory changes and regulatory reforms happening, if the docs aren't involved, then it's usually not a great policy that's put in place. And so that was really important to me as someone that prescribes narcotics on a daily basis, to be able to get something that's really effective and useful.
So the basic goals of this, of the new guidelines, Dr. Miller, you all provided me with this, identify and treat the cause of pain, use non-opioid therapies, start low and go slow, choose close follow-up, anybody want to elaborate on these three? Why are these the big three?
So the way that we built the guidelines, we knew that we had to do guidelines, so I reached out to Mike with he's got an emergency medicine, family practice, addiction, and pain background. So he's kind of got all the different perspectives. And at the same time that we got the ability, like the CDC came out with these guidelines in March, and we got the ability in, I think it was actually also March, it was within a week or two where Governor Walker signed the bill that we could do the guidelines.
Yep.
So that we really based a lot of them on the CDC guidelines. We didn't want to make up, kind of pull guidelines out of left field that weren't really going to be like understood as like standard practice. And so the basis, and you know, Mike really created them, and I helped help author them a little bit as well. But we got input from a lot of different sources. We put together. So we saw that we're going to need not just guidelines saying, okay, these are the guidelines, and here, you know, we wanted to implement them from within the system. So we wanted them to be a part of the cultural change that happens within, you know, in medicine. And so we put together a coalition of stakeholders of health systems and medical society and hospital association, and there's some pharmaceutical companies and nursing and insurance, and it's really just kind of a how do we, you know, this big broad coalition of how you can incorporate the guidelines. So we got some input from stakeholders as well. So I mean, you really were more.
Are they pretty rigid and pretty tough standards, Doctor?
They're in line with
evidence. Vis-a-vis other states, are they tougher than other states?
I think not entirely. There are several states that have actually made violating guidelines illegal. So doctors in those states, particularly Ohio and Washington, if a doctor violates their state board guidelines, the board doesn't call them up and say, hey, you need to get some more education or we're going to take your license away. The state board calls up the state's attorney's office and has them arrested. So
our guidelines do not do that.
They do not.
But
and the board doesn't function that way.
What's the enforcement mechanism of our guidelines?
So our guidelines are our best practice guidelines. So what we're looking at is what is the ideal practice. So the medical examining board is responsible for determining minimal competence. So it's possible that someone could practice outside of those guidelines and it not be, you know, it not meet minimal competence, or and have that meet minimal competence not be incompetence. And so it's really more of a goal of, okay, this is the best, but there's going to be cases where it's where you need to do other things. And we wanted to leave leeway for doctors to be able to practice the way that they saw fit, but also be able to say, you know, okay, this is kind of the state and the national standards, and so if I'm deviating from that, it should be for a reason, that, you know, and there are cases of exceptions.
It's like the speed limit.
Could someone lose her or his medical license to prescribe as a result of violating these new guidelines?
I think in an extreme case, yeah. Definitely. And again, looking at this with a broad perspective of several decades is actually important. And also being patient and recognizing we're not going to fix this in 2 years is also important. It's going to take a while to get us back to a medium point. But when there was this push with tons of evidence about how it was pharmaceutical industry funded, to get more pain medicines prescribed, mm-hmm. One of the strategies was to work with the Federation of State Medical Boards, the national group that our medical board belongs to, amongst the other 50-plus boards, including, you know, territories and such. There were guidelines from the Federation of State Medical Boards saying, don't under-recognize pain, don't under-treat pain, and some doctors were given regulatory citations. You have ignored this patient's pain. You didn't do all you could for it, and we're going to mandate you to get education to be a better pain doctor in primary care or otherwise. You can look at guidelines, and I don't think one should, as a gotcha mechanism. The most extreme form of gotcha is what we really decry, which is criminalizing medical practice. Physicians should have their licenses taken away potentially, but criminalizing medical practice is something the doctors really aren't very warm to, and so that's really a gotcha mentality. But truly, these guidelines are available as a means for Tim and his colleagues on the medical board to make disciplinary decisions, but really it's part of education. It's truly just part of a broad thing of getting doctors to realize the issues, accept that we were misled, accept that physician leaders, even on medical boards, even in medical schools, were misleading. We all were part of it, okay? And my role in this, I was not part of drafting these guidelines, but from the Wisconsin Medical Society, where I've been in leadership for a long time, we put forth a policy saying that we believe that a condition of relicensure should be education on opioid prescribing and pain management. This is the first time Wisconsin has ever had a topic-specific continuing education mandate tied to licensure. California has many. We've never done it. So the Medical Society, several years ago, adopted policy saying, you know, if this mandate is placed on us, we think that's actually good for the public health. And so this document educates physicians about what works, what doesn't work. It probably could have gone further in informing physicians about their role as patient educators regarding safe medication, safe storage. And also the issue that Tim has referenced many times. He talks about it, a culture shift. It has to do with patient expectations of what happens when you have pain. And is it a reasonable expectation that when you have an illness or an injury, there's something that can happen that will make you perfectly comfortable? That is not a realistic expectation. To have physicians compassionately talk with their patients about, we will take the edge off of this. Complete symptom relief is not my goal and should not be your goal. And that overprescribing of opioids is such a public health problem. What may be good for you in this instance as my patient is a problem from a population standpoint, and a message to physicians that I try to give, because I do a lot of teaching, and I know that the director of the CDC, Tom Frieden, who now is, you know, speaking about this in every possible forum, the message is when opioids are prescribed, you cannot separate the two things. It can be helpful clinically for one patient, but from a population standpoint, it carries risk. You're putting risk into the community. And it's not an either or, it's an and. And as long as we recognize that every single prescription contributes to a larger problem. Every single prescription needs to be tightly watched at home, and as soon as you're done with it, don't save it for the next time you have an injury. Don't just keep it there because it's a matter of convenience and you won't have to pay a $20 copay to go to your doctor to get a supply. Don't look at it as your convenience. This is a real problem. Your kids can get into it. Your grandkids can get into it. Your neighbors can get into it. Somebody can break into your house and get into it. At a real estate open house, people can get into it. The medicine cabinet needs to be looked at as a part of this epidemic. And I think we're going to get this message through PTAs, through Rotary clubs. It's going to work.
Well, that was my next question. How do we make Wisconsin medical professionals with the ability to prescribe aware of the new guidelines and the new emphasis, because it's a major new way of thinking and treating patients? So what's the, is there a PR effort? How are we reaching the medical professionals?
So that's a very good case in point. And again, that's where we needed to not just have it be a top down, which a lot of states, they put these guidelines out and then they just leave it to the docs to figure out how to do it. Well, you know, Mike came to me about a year ago and said, hey, there's gonna be a big change when this hits, because it's, and so what's the best way to manage that? And so we came up with this strategy where we're bringing in the health systems from across the state. So we had a meeting a few months ago and we had representatives, chief medical officers from I think around 60 health systems that represent like almost 100% of the, it's not all the systems involved, but it represents 100% of the state geographically. And so what we're looking at is how do we incorporate that? So not just like, you know, here's the guidelines, but okay, what does that mean? Where do you put them on the computer system? How do you incorporate it into your office practice with the new prescription drug monitoring program requirements? How do you work, you know, optimize the workflow of those so that it doesn't, because one of the big things as a practicing physician, a lot of healthcare mandates that come down from the federal government, although well-intentioned, really don't have their effective consequence. So it's really important to me to operationalize this in a way that's useful for physicians. So it make it a mandate that's actually clinically useful, which it can be, and that's what we're trying to operationalize.
Yeah, I work for a very large healthcare organization, and I've actually worked with their medical information people so that there is a template for documentation of your chronic pain patients. It's quick and easy. It's okay. 10 questions, yes or no, and doctors can just automatically call that up for their patients, and it helps remind them to do the best practices. The licensing board is going to make it mandatory in 2017 that every doctor in Wisconsin has to take education about this issue on the guidelines themselves in order to get their Wisconsin license renewed. And but I think in the end, it may not be, I mean, this is all going to help a lot, but what is actually going to put teeth in guidelines like these is the fact that, first of all, they're based on the evidence. There's overwhelming evidence supporting these guidelines. And insurance companies are paying a lot of money for drugs, for a lot of these drugs that people are being prescribed. OxyContin is very expensive, and in many insurance companies, it's the most expensive drug that they pay for in terms of volume. Once they realize that these guidelines are based on the evidence, they're going to stop paying for a lot of this excess prescribing, and that will really dramatically change.
Two final questions, because time is getting away from us here. Number one, is there pushback from some Wisconsin medical professionals who've been doing it the old way? I'm not saying over-prescribing, but doing it the old way. Is there pushback from some of your peers on these new standards and guidelines?
Well,
expectations?
I think it's going to be interesting going forward. We certainly don't want people with pain to suffer unnecessarily. Right. And again, Mike is correct. Some of these things, these national efforts, the efforts through the Joint Commission on Accreditation to get all health systems to look at how people deal with pain assessment, started right here at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. And it began with the issue of cancer pain and end-of-life pain. Okay, we don't want anybody in an end-of-life situation to be deprived of treatment, anybody with cancer pain. And there could be some other patients who may benefit, who may have their functioning improved. The data says that overall, very few people are helped by chronic opioid therapy when it's not a cancer or end-of-life situation. So there could be some pushback. Quite honestly, the American Society of Addiction Medicine, we're having a public policy committee meeting next week to develop a policy to say, hey, guidelines like this, again, the CDC guidelines is what prompted this. Mike said to Tim, the CDC's coming down with these guidelines. Let's have a Wisconsin version and a Wisconsin response. The CDC guidelines talks about morphine equivalent doses. morphine equivalent doses don't work when you're using methadone to treat addiction, when you're using buprenorphine to treat addiction. In pain management, the morphine equivalent doses are very important. In addiction treatment, you got to have an exception to the rule to make sure your dose is effective to treat the addiction. So there will be areas where tweaking is needed. There will need to be some fine tuning. But let's recognize the big picture is that doctors need to understand the issues in a different way. We need to recognize that continuing medical education for a solid 15 years, funded by pharma largely, pushed this message, prescribe more. And we have, many doctors feel that you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. You're either called an underprescriber or now you're called an overprescriber, and somebody's going to slap your wrist for something. We need to be compassionate about this issue, recognize that we need to turn this big ocean liner around. We need to educate differently. But yeah, there will be pushback along the way. But I really don't believe that this was developed to give Tim a tool to take licenses away. This was the tool to help doctors practice better and our communities to be safer.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Final question, just because of time constraints. Mm-hmm. One, you are all professionals in this field. One encouraging development as this nation confronts this epidemic. Dr. McNutt, can you go first? Final question.
Yeah,
final round.
I think we're seeing a leveling off in deaths, and I think we're starting to see a turnaround. As we change these practices, these deaths are decreasing, and that's very gratifying to see. But we haven't done enough yet.
Okay, Dr. Wesley.
Right, I'm encouraged. I think we're laying the groundwork to make the cultural shift that we need to have happen. I also want to give props to Senator Johnson. He came out with the Promoting Responsible Opioid Prescribing, the PROP Act, and that essentially untethers pain reimbursement from pain quality measures, financial reimbursement from Medicare. And Medicare, under that pressure, and even though they knew that physicians thought that was a major issue with the pain scale, had done nothing about it until he released that act. So I'm a huge proponent of that act, I think, just as far as, because I'm looking at what we can do culture-wise. And again, I think the cultural changes are starting to happen. There's an unprecedented amount of awareness about this issue. So I think we're on the right path, especially in Wisconsin. Senator Baldwin's been leading the way, too, with the VA reforms that actually model after what we've done here in the state. So we've got, it's a bipartisan issue, a nonpartisan issue, where it's really about just our patients, and it's about taking care of our families.
What encourages you, Dr. Moore?
What encourages me, I'm a kind of a policy wonk. I'm a political junkie, as are many viewers of Wisconsin. And the thing that impresses me, I mean, realize I've been practicing addiction medicine for 37 or something years. You know, addiction's been out there and nobody talked about it. Nobody talked about it. Now everybody's talking about it on both sides of the aisle. So he talked about the National Governors Association. Two-thirds are Republican governors. The administration obviously is run by the president, who's a Democrat. The executive branch has had summits. I've been a Wisconsin representative to go to summits by SAMHSA. The president has now sponsored this opioid prescribing summit, a whole different one that the CDC is involved with. But if you talk to the candidates, and Hillary Clinton has talked about this, she says when she goes around to listening sessions back in, you know, Vermont, New Hampshire, Wyoming, what have you, she did not go into this campaign. You know, she's been campaigning for years. She didn't really ramp it up until, you know, these last 2 years. But when she goes out, she said she didn't expect this to be an issue. This was not on her radar screen. And the public at listening sessions in small towns says, heroin's in our town. Our kids are dying. What can be done? The nation is calling for answers. The fact that everybody realizes that it's everywhere, that all politicians are talking about it, the media is talking about it. This is what's encouraging. It's out of the darkness.
Yeah.
And that's why Wisconsin Eye welcomes you and thanks you for helping us understand the issue and the progress in the new guidelines. My thanks to Dr. Michael Miller, Dr. Tim Westlake, Dr. Michael McNutt. Gentlemen, thank you. Maybe in a little while we should continue at round two with the progress made in a year or two.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
very much.
Very nice program. Thank you.